Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. My guest today is Denny Rancourt. Denny is very important to me and to this program, and it should be to listeners, because not only is Denny a distinguished tenured professor of physics, a recognized expert in his field, he's also an environmental science expert. He was at the University of Ottawa until the university betrayed him. We've discussed it on the program before. It had nothing to do with his expertise in the classroom, his expertise in his fields. It had everything to do with his supporting, as I like to put it, supporting right over wrong. It's one of my favorite expressions. In his case, it could be on many issues. One of important one for Denny is also an important one for me. Supporting the rights of the Palestinian people to have the same ones as the Jews in Israel, Palestine, and of course they don't. And some people, when they speak openly about how they feel about this and the injustices that have gone on for so long and the need to correct them, sometimes people they're associated with or work for or with don't approve of that. They have another ideology. Well, I guess I'm lucky because I'm retired. I do this in my retirement. It's become a great, important thing for me to do. My writing along with it, lots of interviews, had one yesterday, have another one I know about the next week. I'm sure there'll probably be another one or two before the week is over. That's the way my weeks usually run. And I get a chance to speak freely, and I don't have to worry about a boss firing me or my fellow workers or whatever not approving of what I have to say. I was kind of outspoken during my working life, although for the most part I tried to keep business and my personal opinion separate, at least during business hours. But that's another issue. So many things concern me now. This morning I've been working on an article about Obamacare. Denny lives in Canada. I don't think the healthcare system is perfect anywhere in the world, but Denny, I believe in Canada, everybody is covered and nobody is left out. Is that correct?
That's basically correct. Yes, it is.
And everybody gets the same plan?
Yes. It's a nationally funded plan, and it's the same for everyone.
So if you're the president or the prime minister of the country, or if you're Denny Rancourt, you get exactly the same health care coverage?
In principle, that's right. Now, of course, wealthy people can always go outside of the country to get faster treatment or a treatment that would not exist or that is not funded by the government. They can do that if they want. But in Canada, there is the treatments that are funded are approved on scientific bases and in terms of their efficiency and that they actually work and so on. Same thing with the drugs. They have to be approved. The one thing that does not exist in Canada at the moment is that the medications, the drugs, are not covered by this health plan. And so they can be very expensive. And so there you have private coverage that comes into play. A lot of unionized workers have drug coverage and so on. But there would be a big advantage to making the drugs covered, because what that would do is that it would allow the government to bargain much better deals on the prices of drugs, and it would also allow the government to rule out drugs that are dangerous or that are not effective enough, you know, that don't really work, that are just money-making scams for the pharmaceutical companies. The government would play a role, if it were funding these medications, it would play a role in making sure that the medications that are funded are actually, safe and actually work, and not just some small incremental benefit in some cases and dangerous side effects in other cases. But those kinds of medications, if the government, a new government program were implemented, in principle, those kinds of medications, which are very expensive and which are pushed by the pharmaceutical companies and unfortunately prescribed by a lot of MDs, those types of medications would be eliminated in the sense that they would not be funded by the federal program. So there is a movement in Canada to get the drugs funded in this way as well. And the logic is the one that I just explained, that you then have at least a bit of leverage, because you're a big buyer, you have a bit of leverage against those multinational pharmaceutical companies.
Denny, is that ever true? That is absolutely true. My understanding in America is when Medicare was established in 1965, and I paid into the system from day one. I did not pay into Social Security when it was established in 1935. I was only 1 year old, so I wasn't quite ready for Social Security payments at that time, but they were very, very cheap. But drugs were left out of Medicare, and my understanding was back in 1965. I didn't use drugs back then. I don't use too many now. They can be very, very expensive. But my understanding was back then, drugs were really cheap compared to the cost today,
right.
And it just wasn't thought to be that urgent to include it in Medicare. It was a terrible oversight. They should have included drugs. They should have included dental. I mean, anything to do with health should have been included in a health plan, but it wasn't. And then during the Bush administration, they came up with what they call Part D, which is an abomination. I've been on Medicare since 1999, so I'm an old-timer on Medicare. It works well, except the cost for me keeps going up all the time, which is not the contract I signed, because Medicare is the equivalent of a personal insurance company a policy. It's no different. You pay your premiums through payroll tax deductions, and the contract is when you retire or become eligible in some other way, disability or whatever, you're entitled to free health care. Free my foot. I need a supplemental policy that costs a good bit, and those premiums keep rising. And Medicare takes a deductible from me out of my Social Security monthly payment. So you put those two together, and it comes down to where I have to spend a lot of money every month to get my free health care, and again, it keeps rising. And
right.
I opted out of the Part D, the drugs, because it's a terrible system they set up. The drug companies wrote the legislation. They got exactly what they wanted, so they can rip off consumers, and unless you're very poor and get government subsidies, you really get cheated.
Yeah. Well, another big problem with the health system in both our countries is that the medical establishment is far from perfect. In fact, it's a little known fact, unfortunately, in the public that, you know, the third leading cause of death in North America is medical error itself. Okay, so the first two causes of death, main causes of death, the first one is, you know, cardiac problems, attacks, basically, you know, heart attacks. The second leading cause of death is cancers, all forms of cancer. And the third one is actual medicine itself, the establishment medicine itself. You wouldn't believe how dangerous it is to walk into a hospital. The death rates in hospitals is incredible. And the death rates, whenever you're prescribed anything or given some treatment, there's high risk associated with it because medical error is so common. And there have been some mainstream studies of medical errors, and they were shocked to find how high the rates were. So we're talking just about death now, not even just, you know, serious harm that does not necessarily lead to death. That's a major, major problem that's not being dealt with by the medical establishment right now. And it's especially important because you have to know that the first two leading causes of death, which each correspond to about a quarter of the deaths, let's say, roughly, the medical establishment can't do anything about those causes of death. They cannot. They can barely just alleviate some of the symptoms. They claim to make your life a little bit more comfortable with really aggressive treatments such as chemotherapy and radiation and so on. A lot of the studies, when medical researchers look at the studies that claim that there's some benefit to these treatments, they actually find that in the majority of times there is no statistical benefit. There's no the evidence is just not there that there's an actual benefit from these treatments. There's that big problem that needs to be considered as well. It's very significant. And at least when you have a government funding the thing, there's more chance that there will be studies into these problems and there will be some programs to fix these problems, you know, because they also regulate the medical profession. So there's at least a chance if people in a democratic society pressure their governments, then they can get these things fixed. But right now there's a huge hush-hush about how bad establishment medicine actually is for your health. I've written a lot about this, and I've studied it in detail. And, you know, you can estimate that if the medical establishment were to disappear tomorrow, the death rate would go down. It would act. There would actually be a net benefit in terms of survival. because you know, the fourth leading cause of death is way below the third one, which is these medical errors. So this is a very, very serious problem that needs to be addressed. So medicine is quite good at trauma intervention. You know, if you have a car accident, if you have a heart attack, in the immediate, they'll be able to save you. If you have a stroke, for example, and you get into the hospital quickly, they'll be able to help and solve the immediate danger of that stroke. So these kinds of trauma interventions, they're very good at. And that tends to be one of the only areas where they're clearly good. Most of the other stuff, your body heals itself if you have rest and good conditions, or they simply can't do anything about it. In terms of actual long-term heart conditions or cancer, they just can't do anything about it. You either have a lethal form and they diagnose it and you know you're going to die, and you might as well just do the best you can without suffering these horrible treatments, and look at the quality of your remaining days, or you have a benign form of cancer. A lot of cancers are not fatal, and there's nothing. And when they test you and repeatedly follow the cancer to see if it's going to develop, in quotations, all of that testing and the stress related to it, studies have shown it's actually more harmful than if you just left the person alone. So there's a lot of criticism to be made about how medicine is being wrongly associated with health. So that's something that needs to be said as well.
Denny, I am aware of a lot of what you said, not all the statistics. I remember hearing long ago how deadly a place hospitals can be.
Besides
medical errors, I mean, it's an infection. It's an infection factory. I mean, you've got sick people with all kinds of problems, and there are all kinds of germs and infections floating around the place. And if you can, avoid hospitals at all costs unless you need to be there. If you need to be there, you don't have much of a choice. But ideally is get in and get out as soon as you can and get away from that place and get to some place that is free from all of these problems. But I do know there are plenty of medical errors, and some of them can end up being very, very serious.
Oh yeah, it's more than plenty. As I said, it's an astronomical amount. I've written articles about it. I think you're looking at. Oh, I'm just going from memory now. I'd have to pop up my latest article, but I think you're looking at 200,000 deaths per year in the U.S. alone.
Mm.
Okay, that's pretty massive. That's what we're talking about. So. It's not a small phenomenon, and it's not one. And the other thing is that number is a robust number from scientific studies, but those same studies will tell you that it's an underestimate. It has to be an underestimate because there are a lot of deaths that are caused by medicine but that don't get reported as such. You know, for example, you already have cancer, and if they left you alone, you'd live a long time. But there's this recommended treatment, which later they find out, you know, actually is worse for you and will probably kill you sooner. And so they prescribe that, or they prescribe two drugs that interact in a negative way and they kill you. But since you were already diagnosed with cancer and they'll call it a cancer death, and so on, you know. So there's a lot of misattribution of death as well that makes it such that this estimate is an underestimate for sure, according to the experts, you know.
Well, I think these are statistics that the people who are involved officially in these programs do not like getting out. They don't want to see stories about it. They don't want to see headlines. They don't want to see TV reports. They want this kept as quiet as possible, Denny.
Yeah. So I've written a lot of articles about public health and medicine, and, I mean, your listeners can find these articles on one of my blogs. It's called Activist Teacher, activistteacher.blogspot.com. A lot of my articles about that are on there. But, yeah, it's a serious problem. But, you know, there are two large professional areas that I am very critical of because I think they need complete reform. One of them is the medical establishment that we've just been talking about, but the other is the legal establishment. I have come to the conclusion that the legal system needs an overhaul, a complete reform with a capital R. It is absolutely treacherous, and it is the opposite of a justice system. And recently I've gotten involved in the Ontario Civil Liberties Association, and I've become the self-represented litigants work group coordinator under that umbrella of the Ontario Civil Liberties Association. And in that function, because my email is on the website as being the coordinator of this work group, I get emails from self-represented litigants from across Canada, and I am just appalled at the stories that I hear. And when I get a story, I'll research it, you know, because a lot of these people have been in court, so you can find the rulings that they've been involved with. You can find some documents, and it's overwhelming how bad the problem is. And there's recently in Canada been a law professor did a national study of self-represented litigants and came to the same conclusion that virtually all self-represented litigants are of the strong opinion and have interpret their experience in that the court system has a systemic negative bias against them because they're self-represented. That's the overriding conclusion. Now, think of it. There's a lot of litigants that are self-represented in the system. They virtually all have the opinion that they're not being treated fairly, that the system is biased against them. Now, either they're all mistaken, or they're crazy, or something, or there's some truth to this perception that they have that there's this horrible negative bias. And what's interesting is, in this law professor's study, there's several lawyers that had practices, and they decided to represent themselves in some of their own cases. And these lawyers were shocked to see the difference in behavior of the courts when they became self-represented litigants. So these are lawyers themselves who decide to represent themselves instead of hiring another lawyer when they're being sued or whatever, and they are in shock to see how badly the system treats them because now they're in that category, you see.
Denny, does Canada have what America has, that if someone does not have legal representation, if they can't afford it, then the government, by law, must appoint an attorney to represent them? Of course, you don't get very much when the government appoints someone to represent you. You get very, very poor representation. Does Canada have something like that?
Only in the criminal system.
In the criminal system, okay.
And there's a measure of that also in the family law system. But in the family law system, there are strict controls on it. You have to actually be in need of money. Like there are strict financial criteria, and they also have strict rules. And if you break any of these rules, you're cut from this lifeline of getting some support for your legal defense. So as a result, there are many, many litigants in the family law system that would need representation and that are forced to be self-represented. So, you know, there's just these horror stories of these poor parents who, you know, there's been a nasty divorce, there's kids that are being fought over, there's money that's being fought over, sometimes some property or a house or something, and sometimes one of them is forced because of their financial circumstances to be self-represented, or because they broke some rule in the past or something, where the other one is not and can hire a lawyer or whatever because they had a ruling in their favor or they happen to have more money. And so you get this large asymmetry of power in the courts between the two parents, and so you can guess what the outcome is. One of the parents is going to be made out to be this horrible person that can never have contact with the children and that must pay alimony even to the other person, even though they would have kept the house and so on. You can imagine how this goes, right? But there's real horror stories in the family law system, and that's where most self-represented litigants are in Canada. But there's also a significant number in the civil law system. That, understand, presently there's 15 or 20% of, maybe I think more like 15% of litigants in the civil law system are self-represented, which is a huge number. It used to be virtually zero. One of the reasons for this phenomenon is that you can't hire a lawyer at a reasonable price anymore. And the reason for that is globalization. I mean, corporations are so big and important, they hire all the lawyers and they pay them massive amounts, and the lawyers become these lackeys for the corporations, basically. They're the attack dogs of the corporations. And so the lawyers that are not hired by corporations, therefore, are not getting paid. People can't afford them. Ordinary people that are not corporate persons can't afford the rates that have shot up because of the huge demand on the basis of corporations and big institutions. And so there is no affordable legal aid anymore. I mean, regular lawyers that you could just hire. Nothing's affordable anymore. The costs are going through the roof. And so as a result of that phenomenon, people who are being sued or who want justice, who find themselves, it's the risk of how much you're going to owe your own lawyer is greater than the money you would like to recover or protect yourself from in the lawsuit itself. And so you're forced to become self-represented. Also, the great majority of self-represented litigants really just don't have the funding for it. So that's part of the problem there. But an even more bothersome feature of this system that really irks me is to see how biased the courts are. That when you walk into a system like this, you expect that the courts will have some restraint. There'll be constraints on the court. For example, they'll have to respect logical and valid legal arguments. They'll have to take the facts into account. They'll have to admit evidence that's obviously relevant and take it into account. You expect that there's these rules of logic and of fair play that are going to be followed. And what you find is that they're not followed at all. They're disregarded entirely by the lower courts. Now, of course, I'm generalizing, and this is my opinion, but they're disregarded, especially when the judges feel they can get away with their behavior and their flippant sort of brush this aside and I'll do what I want kind of attitude. So what are the circumstances where they feel they can get away with it? This is my interpretation of what's happening. In cases where you have two large corporations fighting it out, the judges pretty much have to, cut the baby in the middle and behave and hope to avoid that there'll be an appeal at the end of it and that there'll be more court costs to the system and that their ruling will risk being overturned and so on. So the judges tend to behave when you've got equal opponents, and especially when you've got opponents that are big and that have, we're represented by lawyers with high status and so on, then you get a kind of mediation kind of ruling out of it, and the judge just does the best they can to balance the two sides, So that's when it works. But as soon as you get asymmetry in power, So if you have a corporation suing an individual that then has to hire a lawyer that they can afford, who's not even recognized by the court, doesn't, their reputation's not known, that the judge doesn't have anything to worry about, or it's a self-represented litigant on the other side, so there isn't even a lawyer involved. So in a case like that, and they have no money, and it's in your face that they have no money. Well, the judge doesn't, there's no constraint. There's nothing to keep the judge in line in a situation like that other than their own conscience and their own professionalism. And in my experience, from the things I've seen going to court and in my own case, that's not enough. That's just not enough. The judges, you look at rulings, if you're very familiar with the evidence, what you notice is that the judges simply, even when they state what the facts are in the case, they misstate what the facts are. They ignore highly important facts. They don't put it in their ruling. And then they give the ruling that they want to give. And you really feel like they decide ahead of time and then they write their reasons accordingly. And also you can tell from how they treat you in court itself at the hearing. It's terrible the way that they treat you as a self-represented person. They can be highly disrespectful, and they don't punish the lawyers on the other side for being disrespectful. So you feel, emotionally and psychologically, it's very, very difficult to be subjected to that kind of treatment in a system where the judge has enormous authority, can accuse you of contempt of court, can put you in jail at any moment, can, you know, make a ruling of costs against you that is horrific, where you'll owe the other side a lot of money. I mean, the judges have a lot of power, and in circumstances like that, when they're being disrespectful and not even, you know, interrupting you, refusing to hear your arguments, cutting the session short before you've had time to say what you want to say, all these kinds of behaviors, it's devastating. It's very, very hard. So this is the experience. And I've heard from many self-represented litigants that the judges will scream at them, that they'll disrespect them, that they'll use body language that is highly disrespectful. I've seen judges and how they glare and sneer and so on. None of this, of course, gets put into the court transcripts. You know, in Canada, that's one of the advantages you have in the United States. A lot of the court sessions in the United States are filmed, and the videos are available publicly. That is not the case in Canada. You have to fight for the right for something to be filmed, and only the Supreme Court has video reporting of the hearings as they're happening. None of the lower courts, provincial courts of appeal and the lower courts, you can't bring a camera in there. And they don't have a system whereby they're filming their own procedure. So it's you know, they pretend that there's an open court principle, but in fact they don't allow you to film. They don't allow the media to record and to film and to report based on that material. They don't, they're highly controlling, and there are many things that you're not allowed to see. For example, when they cross-examine a witness who has put forward an affidavit in a civil case, that gets done behind closed doors in private. And this is a witness in a civil case. And I tried to have an open court principle applied in circumstances like that, and I was told, no, we just don't do that. And the judge wouldn't even give fair consideration to the well-established principle of the open court in coming to his ruling. He just basically said, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but he basically said, we don't do that. You know? So there's some massive problems. The system is just an arm of a government and police system that wants to completely control people on a basis of the class structure and maintaining elite control of the population. That's how I see it, and that's how people, ordinary people, are living it. You know, students decide to demonstrate in the streets against some government policy in Montreal, and they'll arrest 3,000 of them and completely violate their civil liberties, just arrest, you know, blanket arrest of huge numbers of people, and then they put them through this horrific system. The great majority of them have a hard time finding a lawyer. They don't have money. They're forced to sign these conditions that severely restrict their civil liberties. They can't associate with their friends anymore. There are all kinds of court orders or conditions related to bail that are just draconian. You feel like you're in Stalin's Russia or something, you know? And this is routine. This is how the system treats people. So this is very, very serious.
Anyway, we're coming up on break, and I want you to hold your thought and continue.
Okay.
I would just stress that you're speaking from personal experience. You've seen the dirty system on the inside. I've written plenty about it myself, Denny, writing about dozens, literally dozens of political prisoners, most of them in America, some in Canada, some in Israel, some in other countries. And it is really horrific how innocent people are so grossly mistreated. And as you say, Denny, the system is entirely rigged against them. The phrase I like to use is, when you go up against the system and they want to get you, you're guilty by accusation. It doesn't matter if you're innocent or guilty. You're guilty when you walk into a courtroom, and they're going to be certain that they find you guilty. And in some cases, extraordinary people, and I know one personally who's have been discussed on this program, Lynn Stewart, serving a 10-year sentence for doing what? For supporting right over wrong. Again, one of my favorite expressions. Lynn, they should build a statue to her. They should honor her. And she's in prison for 10 years, and she's dying. Another issue. It's a horrible system, Denny. It's the same in Canada. It's the same here. Certainly it's the same in Israel. It's the same in many other countries. Countries calling themselves democracies, they shame themselves. It goes on in England, goes on in France, goes on in Germany. America is a big country, and America has by far the largest prison system in the world. If I remember my statistics, it's something of the known numbers of prisoners. You never know how many there really are, but of the known numbers, America has something like one-fourth of them, about 2.5 million. More prisoners than China has, with four times the population of America. It shows what a country America is, Denny. We can take a break anytime, and then we can come back.
Okay.
If the band will strike up, that's my cue to take a break. I need to hear the band. There's the band. We will break, and we will be right back.
Okay.
Welcome back. Speaking with Denny Raincourt. Denny, again, the legal system, it's astonishing, maybe to some people. It certainly isn't to me, after all I've written about the gross injustices. But the so-called great democracies of the world, again, America and Canada, Israel, Britain, France, Germany, Italy, these countries aren't democracies at all. Their political systems are completely anti-democratic. And the way they treat ordinary people, especially when these people need most to be treated properly, shows that they are not in any sense democracies. They grossly mistreat people who need a lot better than they get. And it's not isolated examples. It goes on and on and on. And countless numbers are so grievously harmed, and you're certainly one.
It's clear that the lower you are in the social status scheme of things, the more you'll be mistreated by the courts. That's clear. You talked, Stephen, about the 2.5 million prisoners in the U.S. Okay, that's just so bad. But that's in the criminal system. What we have to realize is that there's also a civil system and there's a family law system. And there the numbers are much greater.
Okay. Denny, there can be prison terms for civil cases, But I agree with you that the great majority of prisons in America are for criminal offenses. And in most cases, they're offenses that never should have been called offenses in the first place. So they never should have been put in prison. If you want to smoke pot, that's your business. If you want to cut off your right arm, that's your business. It's your arm, it's your body, it's your health, and the government should have nothing to do with it. So a lot of these people are there for nonviolent crimes, and they never should have been there.
It shouldn't be called criminal at all, it's in the criminal law system is what I meant. But the political prisoners and your lifestyle choices and what you decide to put in your body and all these kinds of things, that should not be within the criminal at all. I agree with you there. But what I meant was, yeah, there's all these people in jail, but there's all these people whose families are being destroyed, who are being put through just a despicable life where there's no chance of ever getting out of it for a long, long time through the family law system and the way that they take, and also the government steps in and takes away the children from both parents sometimes and so on. The destruction, the level of destruction from those kinds of activities is huge. And then you've got the civil cases as well. I mean, it could be something, there's all kinds of times where you need justice in a civil kind of format. And there again, if you're the small person or you're not represented by the right person, you're going to be very, very mistreated. And I want to give you a few examples that I've become aware of that are just out of this world. One example is something that happened just very, very recently. This poor man by the name of Verdun, that's his family name, it's Bob Verdun. Your listeners can Google this name, Bob Verdun, and they'll find that Verdun was sued for defamation by a fellow named Astley, who's a huge businessman. And the problem is that Verdun felt that the whole process, again, was wrong, and that he had never been heard correctly. And so what he did recently is, and I learned this through the through my legal research on the internet, he went and complained to his member of parliament. Well, it turned out there was a restraining order on this guy that had been imposed by the court, an injunction that he was not allowed to mention the name of the person who had sued him and won in this defamation lawsuit. But he went to his MP and he wanted to talk about these injustices. And as a result of that, he was sued again by the same person because he had violated the injunction by going to his member of parliament. Well, the courts found him guilty of having violated the injunction, and that guilty of contempt of court for having done that. And the ruling just came out this year, and I've just been reading it. It's easy to find on the internet if you use the Canlii legal search system, which is free, Canlii, and look at Astley versus Verdun. You can find this most recent ruling where the judge, can you imagine you're talking to your member of parliament? That should be privileged, that you should be able to go in and talk privately to your member of parliament about anything that you think is of concern in society. And because there was a court order of this type, the judge found that he was in contempt of court for having violated the court order. And then there was a sentencing hearing recently where they wanted jail for the man for this. And my research has allowed me to find out that he was put in house arrest for 3 months and all these other horrendous conditions, like, having to report to the judge whenever the judge wants, and restrictions for, a long time after the 3 months of house arrest. This is the kind of treatment, and this was, he barely avoided jail. He managed to get a lawyer for the sentencing hearing and barely avoid jail for this. And when you read the ruling, my hair stands on end. So this is a very recent example right here in Canada this year. Unbelievable.
Every story seems so shocking. Again, Denny, I have literally written about so many individuals. I actually know some of these people because I made contact with them. In the case of America, in the post 9/11 period, America literally declared war on Islam, and most of the people involved are Muslim men, some women, not too many, some women, some animal rights and environmental rights activists, some for other reasons. I personally know two lawyers, Lynn Stewart is one, Paul Bergrib is another, where they were gone after for different reasons. Paul Bergrin wanted defending American soldiers in Iraq, and he wanted people involved in the Iraq War. He wanted to be able to subpoena them to testify, because the soldiers were hung out to dry wrongfully for the crimes of their superiors. He wanted to get the colonel who headed the brigade that the soldiers were part of. He wanted to go up the chain of command. He wanted to go up as high as he could go. And because of that, they went after him, and they charged him with a whole litany of things that he never did, including murder, drugs trafficking, all kinds of things. Well, Paul Bergrim is a very, very effective lawyer. He's a former prosecutor that defense counsels never liked to go up against, because it was very tough to beat Paul. And then when he was a defense counsel, prosecutors didn't like going up against him for the same reason. Well, he's one lawyer, Denny, very capable of defending himself, and that's what he's doing. His case involves multiple trials.
Wow.
I think he's between trials now. I'm not certain when the next one is, but I wrote about one of his trials in some detail, and he beat the prosecutor. He beat the charges against them in the case, but it's only one of many charges, so he has to keep fighting this battle over and over and over. And the way they can get him, Denny, is he could win every single case, and there are so many charges, they literally could keep him behind bars, which is where he is, and have him tied up in court for God knows how many years, maybe
the
rest of his life.
Well, that's one of the mechanisms. That's right.
Yeah.
So, of course, the system has unlimited resources to do this.
Oh, exactly.
And this is what they do. I mean, the golden rule is the system will never go against itself. So you cannot use, the golden rule is you can't use the courts to rectify the system, because the courts are part of the system, and the system will never go against itself. I mean, that's the big picture, right?
Oh, indeed. So, and when you're in prison, you're not exactly most capable of preparing your defense on the specific things as they come up. You need access to law books. You need what a lawyer is used to getting access to. Well, you don't have that stuff in prison, and I have no idea what they have he's in a jail. I believe he's in a New York City jail. I don't know what they have. They probably have no library there at all. So he literally has to do this off the cuff to defend himself. Again,
he might have access to the internet. I mean, they have to allow him to defend himself. Who knows how badly they're treating him? Yeah,
I think they've treated him pretty badly. What they've done to him is pretty bad. I'm not current on exactly what's going on, but I've had personal contact with him, and I do know that he was treated very badly. So I have to believe they may let him do some things that they simply cannot deny him, but they certainly will not do anything they don't have to do. In the sense, with Lynn Stewart,
there's a handful of lawyers in the world, in my country and in your country, that actually try to use the courts and its internal logic to rectify the system and to correct injustices. That, you know, it's not just bargaining between powerful entities, but they actually try to fight for the underdog and to rectify the system. There's a handful of lawyers like that, and the more adamant they are and the more aggressive they are in trying to do that, the more the system will go after them. And a lot of these guys have been disbarred and attacked in various ways and sued, and it's unbelievable. But the good news is, there's a strong civil liberties association that recognizes these individuals and gives them prizes and talks about them and so on. And this is a bit of an ad, but the Ontario Civil Liberties Association here has recognized such a lawyer recently. Or, well, of course, he was disbarred, but his name is Harry Copyto, K-O-P-Y-T-O. Your listeners can Google that, Harry Copyto. He is a remarkable fighter for justice. And, of course, the first thing they did was disbar the guy, and then he became paralegal. He was still allowed to do that. Now they're trying to disbar him from his new career as a paralegal person, continuing to fight these battles. And he is fighting them tooth and nail. He's given them a hard time over many years in these hearings where they're trying to disbar him. And he has a blog where he reports about these hearings. And it's just very entertaining and also, good for the soul to see someone fight back like that and really say what he thinks about what's going on and give his straight-up analysis of all the features of this battle. He does that on his blog. It's great stuff. And so the Ontario Civil Liberties Association is giving this man a prize. There'll be a special event in Toronto on November 8th of this year. And they're going to honor Harry Copyto. It'll be the inaugural Ontario Civil Liberties Association Civil Liberties Award will be discerned to this guy. So that's the kind of good news that we need. We need more and more of it. We need to recognize these people who are attacked and crushed because they're a little too noisy in terms of actually getting justice done. And, the real reason is he was very critical of the legal system. In fact, he was found in contempt of court in a very important case in Ontario, and he defended himself to appeal that charge and got it overturned. It's a very important case related to contempt of court. So the reason they put him in contempt is because he criticized the courts as working with the police to mistreat individuals who are attacked by the police. So he made that criticism, which, to any observer, any astute observer, and all criminal lawyers basically will tell you in private that, of course, the police drum up false charges. Of course they charge you with assault when they've just beaten you up. Of course they do this kind of thing routinely. And the courts more or less condone it because they don't come down hard on the police and they don't try to see whether or not that has happened and they don't anything. So they work with the police. And so he was, complaining about that kind of cohesion between the police and the court system and the Crown and was very, very critical of it. And he was cited in contempt. They were going to put him away. So he won the appeal. This was about 10 years ago. A famous, famous case. So he's the guy now that's being honored, and we need to find these people and talk about them, and they're examples of resistance to this big machine that is mistreating regular citizens and is working for the interests of greedy corporations and institutions that want to control our lives, every aspect of our lives. So that's what we need to do, and I've decided I'm going to do this. I'm going to do everything I can to reform this legal system, all the way up to the Supreme Court of Canada. The Supreme Court is a joke, in the sense that, and what I mean by that is, you can't get into it. They select the cases they're going to hear. You know about this. We've talked about this before. And you've been outspoken to criticize this, but this is a huge problem because when they reject a case, when they don't want to hear an appeal, they don't have to give reasons. And you've screamed about this on the radio. It's outrageous. So that needs to be reformed. They need to be accountable in some measure. There has to be an open court system to some degree. The highest court can't ignore the great majority of cases that are submitted to it and not give reasons.
and they don't give a reason to any on this program. I've read the very dismissive one-liner.
Yeah.
The Supreme Court just you know, it's rubber stamp. It's pro
yeah.
forma. I mean, they issue that I don't know how many hundreds of times, and it really is a very offensive statement where they're basically telling the person who has a legitimate yeah. a legitimate injustice that deserves to be heard, and the court, the highest court of the land, is saying, go to hell.
Yeah, and if and you know, their excuse is a policy excuse that they don't have the resources to give reasons for all the things they have to reject. Well, I'm sorry, that's not good enough. You know, if that's the case, then let's choose some at random where you have to give reasons in those cases. You know, let's hire some more people so that you can do this. It's just not a reason. You know, we're not going to have transparency, and we're not going to be accountable because we don't have the resources to be. Well, then we shouldn't have the resources to run a Supreme Court if it's going to be that way. Either you run it and it's accountable and transparent and seen to be fair as well and gives actual access to justice, or you don't. You know, let's close it down. Let's not pretend, you know. And of course, then you look at the cases that they do choose. And, of course, I'm not talking about the big corporate cases, but the cases that are supposed to be important to regular people. And what they do is they go and get these little theoretical cases that are relatively unimportant in the big scheme of things. You know, they'll go after these crazy things.
Burton Goldberg. We can be at burton@burtongoldberg.com or text me 415-725-3555.
Oh, I think
are you there?
Get rid of it. I think we have a minute or two.
Yeah, I'm very upset because I've in my life, I mean in general right now, because I've come to realize how nasty this so-called this legal system is, and how it works with the police, with the family law system, to the detriment of ordinary citizens, and just how unfair it is structurally and in its practice, and in the bias that is everywhere. It's in the culture to be biased and to be cynical, for the judges, I mean, to be this way. So I've just come to realize this, and it's like I've discovered this very harsh truth, and I need to do something about it. So when I get through my own lawsuits, which is ongoing and is very stressful and very difficult, that's what I want to dedicate myself to.
Denny, I can't think of much that's more important than that. I do it in my way. I do it in my writing. I do it in my media work. And it's extremely important to me. It's literally become my entire life. And both of us, Denny, ended up doing things we never imagined so many years back. You in the classroom and your academic expertise. And writings related to that, and me in a small family business, never dreaming that at age 70 I'd begin writing and become a radio host, and yet now this is my entire life. Denny, I've got to sign off. Again, I appreciate you coming on. A reminder to listeners, join us again tomorrow, same time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.